let's begin this way. Here it is. Again, this was Howard Kunstler, actually, in the Rolling Stone magazine, just published. A few weeks ago, the price of oil ratcheted above $55 a barrel. Now, that's about $20 a barrel more than a year ago. Next day, the oil story was buried on page 6 of the New York Times business section. Apparently, price of oil is not considered significant news, even when it goes up $5 a barrel in a span of 10 days. That same day, the stock market shot up more than 100 points because CNN said the government data showed no signs of inflation. Note to clueless nation, call Planet Earth. Carl Jung, one of the fathers of psychology, famously remarked that people cannot stand too much reality. What you're about to hear might challenge your assumptions about the kind of world we live in, and especially the kind of world into which events are propelling us. We're in for one rough ride through uncharted territory. It's been very hard for Americans, lost in dark raptures of nonstop infotainment, recreational shopping, and compulsive motoring, to make any sense at all of the gathering forces that are going to fundamentally alter the terms of everyday life in our technological society. Even after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, America is still sleepwalking into the future. I call this coming time the long emergency. Most immediately, we face the end of the cheap fossil fuel era. It's no exaggeration to state that reliable supplies of cheap oil and natural gas underlie everything we identify as the necessities of our modern life, not to mention all of its comforts, its luxuries, central heating, air conditioning, cars, airplanes, electric lights, inexpensive clothing, recorded music, movies, hip replacement surgery, national defense, you name it. The few Americans who are not even aware that there is a gathering global energy predicament usually misunderstand the core of the whole argument. The argument states that we don't have to run out of oil and gas to start having severe problems with industrial civilization and its dependent systems. We only have to slip over the all-time production peak and begin a slide down the arc of steady depletion. The term global oil production peak means a turning point's going to come. When the world produces the most oil it's going to ever produce in a given year, and after that, yearly production will inexorably decline. It is usually represented graphically in a bell curve. Peak is up there at the top of the curve, the halfway point of the world's all-time total endowment, meaning half the world's oil will be left. And it seems like a lot of oil, and it is, but there's a very large catch. It's the half that's a whole lot more difficult to extract, far more costly to get, much poorer quality, and located mostly in places where the people hate our guts. A substantial amount of it will never be extracted. The U.S. passed its own oil peak, did you know this, about 11 million barrels a day in 1970. Since then, production has dropped steadily. In 2004, it ran about 5 million barrels a day. Got a tad more from natural gas, yet we consume about 20 million barrels a day now. That means we have to import about two-thirds of our oil, and that ratio is going to continue to worsen. The U.S. peak in 1970 brought on a portentous change in geoeconomic power. Within a few years, foreign producers, chiefly OPEC, were setting the price of oil, and that in turn led to the oil crisis of the 1970s. In response, frantic development of non-OPEC oil, especially the North Sea fields of England and Norway, essentially saved the West's ass for about two decades. Since 1999, these fields have entered depletion. Meanwhile, worldwide discovery of new oil has steadily declined to insignificant, that's an important word, insignificant levels in 2003 and 4. Some cornucopians claim that the Earth has some kind of creamy nugget center, or oil, in other words, that's going to naturally replenish the great oil fields of the world. The facts speak differently, of course. There has been no replacement whatsoever of oil already extracted from the fields of America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world. Now we're faced with the global oil production peak. Best estimates of when this will actually happen have been somewhere between now and 2010. In 2004, however, after demand from burgeoning China and India, and they want a lot, shot up, Revelations that Shell Oil wildly misstated its reserves, and Saudi Arabia proved incapable of goosing up its production despite promises to do so. The most knowledgeable experts revised their predictions and now concur that 2005 now is apt to be the year of the all-time peak global production. It will change everything about how we live. To aggravate matters, American natural gas production is also declining at 5% a year, despite frenetic new drilling and with the potential of much steeper declines ahead because the oil crisis of the 1970s, nuclear plant disasters at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, and the acid rain problem. The U.S. chose to make gas its first choice for electric power generation. Result was, just about every power plant built after 1980 has to run on, guess what, gas. Half the homes in America are heated with gas. To further complicate matters, gas is not easy to import here in North America. It's distributed through a vast pipeline network. Gas imported from overseas would have to come to us compressed at about minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit in pressurized tanker ships, then get unloaded at special terminals. Very few of those exist in America. Moreover, they're tempting targets for terrorism. Some other things about the global energy predicament are poorly understood by the public and even our leaders. This is going to be a permanent energy crisis, and these energy problems will synergize with the disruptions of climate change, epidemic disease, and population overshoot to produce higher orders of trouble. We'll have to accommodate ourselves to fundamentally changed conditions. No combination of alternative fuels will allow America to have the kind of life we've become accustomed to, or even a substantial portion of it. The wonders of steady technological process achieved through the reign of cheap oil have lulled us into kind of a Jimmy Cricket syndrome, leading many Americans to believe that anything we wish for hard enough is going to come true. These days, even people who ought to know better are wishing ardently for a seamless transition from fossil fuels to whatever might replace them. The widely touted hydrogen economy is a particularly cruel hoax. We're not going to replace the U.S. automobile and truck fleets with vehicles run on fuel cells, for one thing. The current generation of fuel cells is largely designed to run on hydrogen obtained from natural gas. The other way to get hydrogen in the quantities wished for would be electrolysis of water using power from hundreds of nuclear power plants. Apart from the very dim prospect of our building that many nuclear plants soon enough, there are also numerous severe problems with hydrogen's nature as an element that present foreboding obstacles to its use as a replacement for oil and gas, especially in storage and transplant. Make that transport. Wishful notions about our rescuing our way of life with renewables are also rather unrealistic. Solar electric systems and wind turbines face not only the enormous problem of scale, but the fact that the components require substantial amounts of energy to manufacture and the probability that they can't be manufactured at all without the underlying support platform of a fossil fuel economy. We will surely use solar and wind technology to generate some electricity for some period ahead, but probably at a very local and small scale. Virtually all biomass schemes for using plants to create liquid fuels cannot be scaled up enough, or even a fraction of the level they're going to have to run things on now. What's more, these schemes are predicated on using oil and gas inputs, fertilizers, weed killers, to grow the biomass crops that would be converted into ethanol or biodiesel fuels. This is a net energy loser. You might as well burn the inputs and not bother with the biomass products. Coal is far less versatile than oil and gas and is less abundant in supplies than many people assume, fraught with huge ecological drawbacks as a contributor to greenhouse global warming gases and many health and toxicity issues, ranging all the way from widespread mercury poisoning to acid rain. You can make synthetic oil from coal, but the only time this was ever tried on a large scale was by the Nazis under wartime conditions, using very impressive amounts of slave labor. If we wish to keep the lights on in America after 2020, we may indeed have to resort to nuclear power, with all its practical problems and eco-conundrums. Under optimal conditions, it could take 10 years to get a new generation of nuclear power plants into operation, and the price may be beyond our means. Uranium, incidentally, is also a resource in finite supply. We are no closer to the more difficult project of atomic fusion, by the way, than we were in the 1970s. Kunstler goes on, suburbia, American suburbia, will come to be regarded as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And he says it has a tragic destiny. The successful regions in the 21st century are going to be the ones surrounded by viable farming hinterlands that can reconstitute locally sustainable economies on an armature of civic cohesion. Small towns and smaller cities have better prospects than the big cities, which will probably have to contract substantially. The process is going to be painful and tumultuous. In many American cities, such as Cleveland, Detroit, St. Louis, the process is already well advanced. Others have further to fall. New York and Chicago face extraordinary difficulties, being oversupplied with gigantic buildings out of scale with the reality of declining energy supplies. Their former agricultural hinterlands have long since been paved over. Still, our cities occupy important sites. Some kind of urban entities will exist where they are in the future, but probably not the colossi of the 21st century industrialism. Some regions of the country are going to do better than others in the long emergency. The Southwest will suffer in proportion to the degree that it prospered during the cheap oil blowout of the late 20th century, I predict. Sunbelt states like Arizona and Nevada will become significantly depopulated, since the region will be short of water as well as gasoline and natural gas. Imagine Phoenix without cheap air conditioning. Unimaginable, actually. I'm not optimistic, he says, about the Southeast either, for different reasons. I think it'll be subject to a substantial level of violence as the grievances of the formerly middle class boil over and collide with the delusions of Pentecostal Christian extremism. The latent encoded behavior of Southern culture includes an outsized notion of individualism and the belief that firearms ought to be used in the defense of it. This is a poor recipe for civic cohesion. The Mountain States and Great Plains will face an array of problems, from poor farming potential to water shortages to population loss. The Pacific Northwest, New England, and the Upper Midwest are somewhat better. They have better prospects. I regard them as less likely to fall into lawlessness, anarchy, or despotism, and more likely to salvage the bits and pieces of our best social traditions and keep them operational at some level. These are daunting, even dreadful prospects. The long emergency is going to be a tremendous trauma for the human race. We will not believe that this is happening to us.